Good afternoon. This room looks very different this time of day than it does when I'm normally up front in the sanctuary. I was thinking this week about what passage I might like to share a few thoughts on with you all, and thinking about the fact that, you know, there are several things going on today and this time of year, and one is the subject we've all gathered to learn a little bit more about, the conscientious objectors in World War I. And also this being the season of Lent and moving toward Easter. So I've chosen a passage from Matthew, chapter 16, and I'm going to begin reading in verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will find it. What good is it for you to gain the whole world and yet forfeit your soul? Or what can you give in exchange for your soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels. And then he shall reward everyone according to what they have done." This passage is kind of a special one in my life. This is actually the first passage I ever preached on. I was invited to preach at my home congregation when I was 18 years old, several weeks after my high school graduation. And I was really excited about the opportunity, and I knew from the moment they asked me, it was going to be this passage that I preach on. Because this was the passage that just burned on my heart through all of my teen years. I felt like somehow the gospel was captured in this passage in a really unique way that the church often failed to talk about. And I remember the sermon very distinctly because it, never having preached before, it never occurred to me that sermons were something that one usually practices or times. So I just wrote a script and got up and started preaching, and it lasted, I'm going to say, roughly 5 to 6 minutes. And I remember thinking, it looks really long on paper. But I also still remember just the sense of passion that this passage stirred for me and still does. I still believe, in some sense, that this captures for us this core, particularly for those of us with Anabaptist convictions, about what this gospel is that we're really sharing and celebrating. I grew up on, like many Mennonite children, grew up on the stories of the martyrs, whether they're, you know, way back in history, the early church, the early Anabaptists, or more recent. And the stories of those who willingly sacrificed their lives for the sake of Jesus' way of the cross. And my biggest concern in childhood, I was really, really worried that if the moment ever came for me where I had to make that choice of my life or my faith, that I wouldn't have the courage to choose rightly. I spent a lot of time laying in bed at night thinking about that and worrying about that. Because how can you know for sure? That's what I'd always ask my parents. How can I know? I'm not sure what I would do. And I asked my Sunday school teacher, how can I know? How can I be sure that if this moment comes for me, I'll choose rightly? And he said, "Well, Megan, you're never going to face that choice. So just don't worry about it." I was never completely convinced that was the solution to this pressing question. But then when I was a freshman in high school, the Columbine school shooting happened, which, as many of you will recall, the story of the high school young woman who gave her life for her faith. And I remember that just raising that question anew for me. It happened not too far from where I was living to someone not too far from my age. In a world where faith and violence so often come into these huge collisions, how can I be sure I'm going to be faithful when I have to make that choice. And there are some, perhaps among us today, and certainly among the people whose stories we're recalling, who know what their answer is. I consider those, I think, the real privileged saints among us who have faced the moments of those pivotal choices and have chosen the way of the cross and know for a fact what their choice was. But there's one thing about this passage in Matthew that we often overlook. It's repeated in the Gospel of Luke with one extra word. Luke says, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take off their cross daily and follow me." And I remember the first time I preached on this passage, I deliberately chose Matthew because that word daily really irked me in Luke. I thought it was such a cop-out. You know, this is what Christians say to each other to make ourselves feel better about not really making the costly choices. Take up your cross daily, everyone. And somehow that just sounds like something Christians say. That question of what would I choose, my life or the cross, seems so much more pressing to me on this grand scale. But I've since changed my mind about those two questions in Matthew and in Luke. Because for me, that question over the years has become not what would I choose, my life or the way of the cross, but what do I choose, my life or the way of the cross? Somehow it's so easy to keep this as a grand hypothetical question, the one that we can ponder and trouble over at night once in a while, or think about when we're reading a book about the lives of the saints. But this really isn't a hypothetical question. We answer it in moments of pressure or some of those grand moments, whether that be the draft or a break into your house or a school shooting. But I think we practice answering it every single day. When Luke says, take up your cross daily, he's taking that hypothetical question and placing it on the ground of our daily realities. I don't think any of us really make that choice in one grand moment, however much it seems in stories like we do. This is a choice we make every day. We lay the ground for it in those more pivotal moments. And I don't think we'll answer any different in the crucial moment than we do on a day-to-day basis. Am I laying my life down today? Today, am I giving myself away for the sake of the cross? How do I choose moment by moment? Am I willing to sacrifice my comforts, my convenience, my preferences, my security to love others more than I love myself? That is Jesus' way of the cross. That's the invitation to discipleship. And that's the choice all of us face every day and in the course of our lives. That defines sort of how we take this path that we're on. So I've discovered, I guess, for me, that the question of what would I do doesn't have to remain a mystery. Every day I get to get up and practice my answer. I get to risk myself and my sense of who I am for the sake of this way of Jesus, taking the cross toward others. And for me, in that question of choosing the cross, we're choosing ourselves, it's a comfort to know that we all get to make the choice, that we all get to choose it over and over, and some days get it right and some days get it wrong, but develop a pattern of life that leads to the right answer in those crucial moments. And that's what I celebrate about being a disciple of Jesus and about the journey that all of us are on this afternoon. It's no longer morning. So thank you.
In 1990, that's not right, 1980, the Springer family moved to Albany, is that correct? Where are you, Ed and Esther? 82? Ed and Esther, and they moved to Albany because Ed became pastor of this church. He was here until about 1990. And then they went to St. Louis. And with them came Melanie, their middle daughter, who was ready to enter the freshman year of high school, which she did at South Albany. Her older brother, Todd, was a junior that year. And the younger daughter, Amy, was in what grade? Grade 5. So this is a story, this introduction begins, I would say, a local girl who made good. We were always very pleased with the Springer family and children as they grew up here. As I said this morning in our worship service, Melanie was on the track team in South Albany. And after graduating from South Albany High School, she went to George Fox University. Got her BA, and then she went with her family when Ed Nestor moved to St. Louis, Missouri, and graduated, got her master's degree, I should say, from the University of Missouri at St. Louis. From there, she went on to Oklahoma State University and got her PhD in English. She is now chair of the English department at George Fox University in Newburgh, which, as you probably read some places, Forbes magazine named the best Christian college in the whole country. They do have high academic standards there. I know she is an outstanding author because I've read her book. And I can imagine that she is a very inspiring and demanding teacher of those English classes with George Fox. I don't know how, and she will tell us a little bit more about her life, I think, when she begins here. But she got interested in World War I research. So she had to become sort of a historian, find out a lot about the background. World War I, and then how the Mennonite Church related to all of this. Maybe I'll just pause here. How many of you in the audience, I guess this would be men, males, at one time or another in your life faced the draft, the dreaded draft? Quite a few of us did. So you might have volunteered before you were drafted. How many of you served in 1W service, could have been in PACS, could have been in VS, could have been at Denver General Hospital or whatever? 1W? Vets? And we have, I think, some World War II CPS veterans here. One, two, Cliff, Les, Cliff Kanagi, Lester Krupp, and Eldon Schrock. Anyone else? How many of you had a father, grandfather, uncle, way back when, who was drafted in World War I? Sam Eicher was about the first to raise his hand. His dad, I remember reading that story about his dad in Ohio. I mentioned this morning, I meant to mention Ori Conrad, and I said Amos Conrad, was sent up to Fort Riley. Elmer McTimmons. Do you have Elmer McTimmon's story in your book? When I was a little boy, we used to go to conference, and my dad he'd go around and meet everybody, you know, such a social person. And I was this little kid tagging along, and he'd always talk to Elmer McTimmon. And Elmer would have his neck up in the air, and he would have a high-pitched voice. I never knew why. How many of you know why that was? He was tortured in World War I. In a military base, which affected his vocal cords. So I'm mentioning several, and maybe other stories you know well too, that come out of the Mennonite experience, COs in conscientious objectors in World War I. In addition to learning about the history, this book documents a lot of things by using 4 diaries. And I'm sure Melanie will introduce us to the young men that she writes about. But word for word, poor grammar or whatever, makes the last half or more of the book so interesting to read what these guys wrote day by day, which again, as historians, we need to emphasize, it's important to write stuff down, whether it's in your church or your family. My dad faithfully kept a diary for most of his life. I've got lots of five-year diaries that Dad wrote. Eldon Schrock here this morning after church showed me where he was in Belton and CPS in World War II. And he says there that Archie Kaufman and Sweet Home preached this morning at Belton. I remember my dad took that trip when I was just a little grade school fellow. But I didn't write a lot of this down. Now, I do journaling today. Now, I would encourage all of us, especially these kind of experiences, to journal or diary or write down. So she gets into personal history as well as church history and national history and world history. It's a real pleasure to introduce Melanie Springer Mott, former member at All Faith Mennonite. After her presentation, there will be time for questions and answers, Melanie can comment on that.
I noticed in both introductions that Ray didn't say anything about my playing basketball for South Albany High School. That's probably because we had the longest losing streak in Oregon history at 0-75. I don't think South Albany basketball is doing much better these days. Well, there's that, yeah. I don't think the girls' team has ever done that. Well, thank you guys very much for having me here today. This is an honor in part because I have never let my parents hear any of my professional presentations, so this is a first. But I'm also glad to be back at a place that was home for me. Albany Mennonite had a formative role in my life, and my youth leaders, Jerry and Nancy, are here, and they were very important to my growing up. I always thought they were old and wise and very mature. And it's humbling to realize they were probably younger than I am right now. I wanted to start my presentation today with a story about Albany Mennonite, a Ford Galaxy 500, and the movie Ghostbusters. Now, Albany Mennonite didn't look like that when I was a kid. We had a Ford Galaxy 500 on the list. If you remember, that was your car that we bought from you for about $200, a princely sum. It was a huge car. We could fit almost the whole Albany Mennonite youth group in that car. Now, the front passenger side door didn't work, and so if we wanted to get in, we all had to slide across the big green bench seats. The driver's side door didn't work, and that will be important in a minute. So one summer night, after a youth group gathering, a bunch of us were piled into the Ford Galaxy 500, driving through Albany. And this was, I think, 1985, when Ghostbusters was a big movie. We're listening to our AM radio, had it blaring, and the song Ghostbusters came on. And we were driving through town, and we stopped at a light. We must have been taking Stacy Steiner, Todd Landis, home. We stopped at a light right by the library. And we're all singing along to the song, and I turned out the window and yelled Ghostbusters at the car next to me. And the man in the car got a horrified look on his face. And I didn't really know why. So we took off in our Ford Galaxy, and the car was right on our tail down Waverly Street, all the way to the end of Waverly Street to South Albany, to that road. And as my brother, who was driving, turned right on that road, the man in the car drove in front of us and stopped the car. And he got out of the car, and he came up to the car, and Todd couldn't roll down the window because it didn't work, so he opened the car, and he grabbed my brother by the neck, and he said, "How dare you call my wife, A," and then a language that I won't use in church. But he had thought we said something else other than Ghostbusters. And he reached back to punch my brother. And at that point, I had a bulletin that said something about Albany Mennonite on it. And I said, "No, sir, stop. no, we would never say anything like that. We're Mennonites. And I held this up so that he could see that we were Mennonites, as if that was going to prove anything. He said, we would never do anything like that, sir. And I was pleading with him for my brother's faith. And he looked at the bulletin or whatever it said, that said Mennonite on it, and he got in his car and drove away. What I take from that experience, other than the scarring memories of it, is that I was able to express to that person that I was a Mennonite, that I was a pacifist, that I would never do anything to harm anybody else, but I couldn't really articulate what that meant to that person. If that person would have said, what does it mean for you to be a Mennonite? What does it mean for you to be a pacifist? I don't know if I could have said what it meant. I'd grown up in the church, and pacifism was almost like given to me by osmosis. I knew that I was supposed to be a pacifist, that I wasn't supposed to fight, that I was supposed to be a kind person, to live by the social gospel, but I really didn't know what that meant. The parallels between my life as a Mennonite youth and that of my research subjects would become really clear to me as I began doing my research a decade after my own Ghostbuster moment. After I graduated from South Albany, I went to George Fox College, mostly because I didn't want to go too far away from home. And I learned there about peacemaking, but it was all from a Quaker perspective. So I hadn't learned, even at that point, what it meant to be a Mennonite, what it meant theologically to be a pacifist from a Mennonite perspective. After I graduated from George Fox, I went into Mennonite voluntary service, convicted that I needed to live by the social gospel, even though I didn't really understand what that meant. In graduate school, I went to Oklahoma State, and at that point, I was introduced to the Great War poet Wilfred Owen, who had a really compelling and sad life. As with many young men of his age, he went into the Great War as a British officer, believing really strongly, convicted that he should go to war, that he should fight. But once he got into the battles, he realized how he'd been fed myths about the war and its grandeur. Unfortunately, he died about 1 week before the armistice, and his parents, as the British people were celebrating their victory in war, his parents found out that he had died. I was enthralled when I learned about this poet, both about because of his personal history, and even more by his writing. Because even though he was an officer in the British Army, he railed against the war in his writing. He wrote poetry declaring his conscientious objection to the war, though he claimed he was a conscientious objector only because he had been to war and he had seen it and he objected to what he had seen. His most famous poem is probably that called Dulce et Decorum Est. And when I read that poem, it called out to me, it spoke to me, in ways no other poet ever had. I'd actually like to play a retelling of his poem, played to music and to images of the Great War, so that you can get a sense of what he was objecting to, and the old lie that he and the Mennonite conscientious objectors were railing against. last line of the poem. Up to that point, Owen is describing watching a soldier die from mustard gas, being poisoned. When a soldier died from mustard gas, it was like he was drowning in his own lungs. And so he's describing this, and at the end he says, "My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori," which is translated, "It is sweet and meet to die for one's country." Sweet and decorous. The friend he was writing to was a poet in Britain who was writing patriotic songs about how wonderful it was to go and fight at the front and how we were all to go march to the front and fight because that was what Mother Britain wanted us to do. So he was responding to this poet. He was responding to the sentimentality of war, the sense of war as something glorious and wonderful. And as you can see from the images behind the poem, the images in the poem, obviously that was not the case. The war was not sweet or decorous. Well, when I read Wilfred Owen's poetry in graduate school as an English student, I was compelled by this indictment against the war, an indictment I soon found that other trench poets of the time shared. The poets, like Owen, were aggravated by the conditions that brought them to the front. They were the rotting mire of trenches in which they lived and the continued loss of friends and comrades for, in the Great War, what would sometimes be just a few yards gain. And there's some other images of the war. Again, you notice it's not sweet or decorous, as Owen found out. Well, when I was getting close to my dissertation, I was needing to find something to write about. And I was compelled about what the Mennonites were doing during the Great War, what they were writing, both poetic and autobiographical. I was interested in my ancestors and my forebears and their response to the war. Because as a Mennonite, I knew that my people had probably not fought in the war. And I sensed that their writing, whatever it might be, would probably echo the indictment against war that I saw in the trench poets. Though again, I was coming as someone who didn't know that much about Mennonite history or about the Mennonite objection to war, and I didn't really have an understanding of theological context. So this was an writing my dissertation, doing this research was an education for me too, in my history, in my background, in my family's past. Anyway, in about 1998, my husband and I set off for Mennonite Archive Libraries in Goshen and Bethel to do research. And I found that Mennonites had done an amazing amount of writing, especially for Mennonites, during the Great War. My husband served as my chauffeur and my errand boy, and he Xeroxed what turned out to be reams of material. Again, I was shocked by how much Mennonites had written because we're not really known as literary people. Not known for our literary eloquence as much as for our good singing and great food. But there it all was. There was treaties outlining the Mennonite response to war, periodicals, articles extolling the virtues of Mennonite non-resistant, autobiographical sketches written by Mennonites who lived through the war, letters from Mennonite leaders to the government, poetry and fiction eulogizing Mennonite objectors. There were diaries written by Mennonite conscientious objectors detailing their day-to-day hardships of being a Mennonite pacifist living in military camps. As I read through all this material, it became clear to me that the Great War had been a difficult time in America. During the Great War, there were about 80,000 Mennonites living in the U.S. in a number of different sects. And we could spend hours and hours just talking about what those different sects were. So when I talk about Mennonites, I'm going to talk about them as a whole, even though there are many different Mennonite sects. They still held firmly to to Mennonite convictions with non-resistance at the core. Though their nonconformity, their use of German language, combined with their non-resistance and their refusal to support the war, made them enemies in America. And this was very hurtful for many Mennonites because they had claimed America as their own. When the U.S. entered the Great War in 1917, the war had already been going on in Europe for 3 years. And during those 3 years, the U.S. had been essentially neutral. But once Wilson declared war against the Germans, the cultural climate in America changed. Government and churches encouraged unfettered war support, conflating American patriotism with love of God and God's will. And if you notice in this slide, Tabor College's main building in flames, supposedly by an arsonist who was angry at Mennonites and felt they weren't being patriotic enough. It shows the religious implications of the culture in America at the time. So during that time, once we entered the war, 1917, there were parades supporting the U.S. entry to war. Americans participated in rallies, got together to sing songs, displayed flags, bought war bonds, and celebrated their son's induction into the Army. This is an example of some of the advertisements that were popular during that time, and you can see, even in the advertisements, the religious nuances of the ads. We have Keep the Hand of Mercy. I can't even read it. Can somebody... Well, you have the ad at its work. You have somebody bending down from heaven. You have an almost religious stance here for a soldier trying to sell liberty bonds. This was kind of the more innocuous manifestation of the country's wartime fervor, a fervor which sometimes bred violence, as those who opposed the war found their churches splashed with yellow paint and their homes emblazoned with graffiti. They received threats from neighbors and the press, were tarred and feathered, and in a few cases were nearly lynched or successfully lynched by angry mobs. Both the pulpit and the government encouraged Americans to see the war as holy, ordained by God to rid the world of the Antichrist. And some of this language probably sounds a little bit familiar. Politicians employed Christian rhetoric to encourage constituents to buy war bonds and to advocate for conscription. And there's just some more ads. If you have German ancestry and you're faced with an ad that says "Halt the Hun" and has a picture of a Germanic person raping almost a woman, that can be problematic. And there's some images of the parades. And consider this advertisement that does a good job of conflating religion and the war. It says, I'd rather you had died at birth or not been born at all than know that I had raised a son who cannot hear the call to save the world from sin. My son, God gave his only son. He's asking for my boy today, and may his will be done. This was an advertisement to try to get young men to sign up for the army, to be conscripted. As you can imagine, this civic religion was problematic for Mennonites who believed strongly in the separation of church and government. Other Americans who were hearing from their government that the war was founded on Christian principles could not understand how Mennonites, who said they were Christians, could reject the war on religious grounds as well. This was a complex struggle with the American government that boiled down to conscientious objector issues. What do we do with conscientious objectors? It's complicated by the Mennonites' own ability to figure out what being objectors to modern war really meant and how they were to interpret the Gospel of Matthew in light of 20th century war. So as a reminder, this is what many non-resistant Christians base their own non-resistance on. But What became problematic is that different Mennonite groups interpreted Christ's non-resistant message in different ways, trying to figure out whether they could or could not support the Red Cross, whether they could or could not take up humanitarian positions like working in hospitals, where they might make soldiers fit to fight again. They had to ask themselves whether they could even farm, because farming meant supporting the war effort. To what extent could they give their own men to the country without giving their men to the war effort? At the beginning of the war, Mennonite groups disagreed vehemently over these issues, causing deep fissures within the church that would complicate the conscientious objectors' experiences in World War I. President Wilson signed the Selective Service Act in May 1917, requiring men ages 21 to 31 to register. Religious objectors had little recourse. They were to register and report to duty when called. Wilson and Secretary of War Baker thought that once conscientious objectors got to the camps, they would see the error of their ways, take up their guns, and go ahead and fight. However, when the objectors reported, they refused not only to drill, but to do other things as well. They believed that even working in hospitals or cutting grass on the camp grounds was abetting the war effort. And so when asked to assume duties as soldiers and trainees, many objectors refused, oftentimes politely, quietly, but with conviction. So the government was at a loss. Many Mennonites couldn't even speak English, had little education, and didn't know how to convey their own resistance. Officers and soldiers expressed their frustration about Mennonites' unwillingness to be part of the military, and Mennonites received abuses as a result. They were beaten, verbally abused, forced to stand in 8 hours a day in the middle of camp while passing soldiers jeered, given diets of bread and water, rubbed raw with wool brushes, burned with hot water, dragged through camp behind wagons. Many objectors were court-martialed and sent to the federal penitentiary for refusing to follow orders. There they were often manacled to their cells for 8 hours a day, with feet barely touching the floor. At least four Mennonites, three of them brothers, died while in prison from abuse, and one was sent home in a coffin wearing the military uniform he had refused to wear when he was alive. Because I'm a literary scholar, I was particularly interested in the life writing, that is, the autobiographies, diaries, letters, that these men, these conscientious objectors, had written. I wanted to study what people had written about their experiences firsthand, feeling like firsthand accounts might provide rich detail on these men's experiences that later accounts would not. There weren't many autobiographies, as it were, but there were a good number of diaries written as an experience was lived. I agree with Ray that the diary is a very powerful means of expression. There's an immediacy in a diary that's not afforded in other modes of writing. And it allows readers, if we get access to diaries, to live life and experience of the moment. I also admit that at least the diaries I read were actually pretty dull. The men's lives were also dull. But I found in the diaries that I read a richness that I found extraordinary. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the men that I studied and their stories, so it'll give you a better sense of the objector experience. These are just some pictures of the objectors, and you can see in this picture of Amish conscientious objectors, they're there with soldiers who are in uniform. Because they refuse to wear their soldiers, they're easy to pick out because they are Amish. All right, Gustav Gadert was one man I studied. He was kept from September 1917, which was essentially at the beginning of the draft, until the end of August 1918. His diary clearly reflected the writer's struggle to decide best how he would act in a conscientious objector camp. And he really reflected the difficulties Mennonites had during the First World War in trying to reach conclusions about what constituted non-combatant duty, how best to perfect the non-resistant witness, and about what kind of service the Mennonites could consciously render while sustaining Christ's precept to love one's enemies. Gustav Gadert was from Inman, Kansas. He played an unusual role in the camp, at Camp Funston and then at Camp Dodge, because he was educated, because he was articulate, and he could speak English. He decided at first that he would do some work in the camp, and so he hauled garbage for a while, but then he ceased to do so and was uncomfortable with that decision. He was uncomfortable with the decision to work and then to not work. He corresponded and became a liaison with H.P. Crable, who was the head of the General Conference Mennonite Church, about what he should do, whether he should work or not. And later he was furloughed to an Iowa State mental hospital where he finished out the war doing work there. Gustav Gadert came to the conclusion after being in the camp that the Mennonites had made the wrong decision during the war in having an absolute rejection of any kind of work. And so in the Second World War, he became a Red Cross volunteer, believing that Mennonites should have assumed a more proactive peace witness, helping soldiers if necessary and doing relief work when possible. In the late 60s, in an interview, he said, "The church may become too narrow in its assertion that non-resistant Christians should have no part in the military, and that by tolling in military hospital, Mennonites are supporting war." He felt that Mennonites could support work in war relief and could bind soldiers' wounds while holding fast to their non-resistant convictions. And he used as a story the story of the Good Samaritan as support for his own point of view. He believed that Christ would have had Mennonites, his followers, actually go and do relief work, and that would not have been against his non-resistant convictions. And there's some pictures of the place he spent a good bit of time in, Camp Funston. The most interesting case I studied was that of J.C. Meyer, who was from Ohio, was conscripted to Camp Sevier and Jackson in Georgia and South Carolina. And what was most intriguing about him is that he was an Amish Mennonite, but he had a master's degree from Harvard, which was unusual for Mennonites in and of itself, especially for Amish Mennonites. He was articulate, well-spoken, and because of this, and because of his Harvard pedigree, he was often paraded in front of officers who couldn't believe a conscientious objector, and especially a Mennonite one, would have gone to Harvard. They were called bovine-faced Mennonites because they were supposedly stupid, uneducated, and J.C. Meyer proved them wrong. Because of his Harvard degree, he developed close ties with the officers, and he began serving as a go-between between the officers and the conscientious objectors, and he received privileges that others didn't have because of his relationship. His diary told another great war story, showing how great a commodity status and education are in military camps, and so how many Mennonites lacking the capital of college or even a high school degree lost the freedom and regard given men like Meyer. At the same time, Meyer's diary suggests that despite the esteem granted him, he remained trapped by a system which refused to honor his conscience. He remained victim to soldiers' taunts and the petty slurs of officers. He was separated from his family and community. And he was made idle and almost useless because he was an objector and the government didn't know what to do with objectors. In time, he began typing up governmental reports for his lieutenant, doing military clerking duties, while also voicing the objector's concerns to officers when necessary. He even went on to build a school in the conscientious objector camps and started teaching objectors typing and English and different things like that as a way of empowering them. He went by the conviction cited in 2 Thessalonians that if any would not work, neither should he eat. And he felt like since he was being fed in the camp, he needed to do some kind of work. Late in the war, he went before the Board of Inquiry, which was set up to try to decide whether conscientious objectors were truly objecting or not, and then went to do reconstruction work in France. later after the war. There was a small confluence in my own life that made this particularly interesting case, in that I found out he had taught my dad at Blessing College later in life, and so that was a nice little connection. And that was Camp Jackson, where he was for a while, Camp Sevier. And there's a pastor. He wrote about the pastor in his diary. I wondered if he actually knew the person in the picture. All right, John T. Neufeld was the saddest diary I read because of the abuses he received at Camp Cody, New Mexico, where he was sent from his home in Kansas. From what I read, Camp Cody seemed like the wild, wild west because it was away from concentrations of Mennonites. Objectors were treated poorly, and more COs were court-martialed there than at any but three other camps in the United States. When he went into the camp in 1918, he endured physical and verbal abuse and then imprisonment, something from which many objectors were spared. He was beaten for disobeying an order to drill, was court-martialed, and sentenced to 15 years of hard labor at Fort Leavenworth. And though other great war objectors would fall victim to graver physical mistreatment than Neufeld, Neufeld's diary is likely the only available remaining holograph which provides a first-hand account of the most difficult trials objectors confronted during the war. During his internment at Fort Leavenworth, he was treated better than many people at Camp Cody, though this was not the case for all objectors, and he was released, not after 15 years, but in January 1919, along with other COs. When he returned to his home community, they were outraged that he hadn't stayed out his whole imprisonment. Some pictures of Camp Cody. The fourth CO I studied, who I ended up liking the best, was a man named Ira Hostetler. If you can like somebody the best who you've never met and don't know. He reminded me, when I heard his voice on a tape interview of 1968, a lot of my grandfather, and so I felt that connection there. He stayed at Camp Funston's and Camp Dodge, where the CO populations were very high. What I like about his diary and about him is there's an authenticity and a rawness that I didn't see so much in the other diaries, and I wondered if it was because of his lack of an education. He graduated from the eighth grade when he was 18, suggesting he was not highly educated. But he took his CO status to the extreme, refusing to wear the uniform or to do any kind of work in the camp. He really saw his time in the camp as being a missionary, hoping to change the minds of the soldiers, and he believed he could change them into being pacifists and thus alter the war, which is an idealism that I find heartbreaking and also really endearing. Hostetler was often the victim of abuse despite his willingness to continue being a witness for his cause. He was furloughed to a farm late in the war where he felt most at home. And then he returned to Harper, Kansas, where he lived his entire life except for that year or so in the war. And the neat thing about this research is that I ended up talking to his daughter on the phone on several occasions. The family was grateful that his story got told, and I was grateful for the opportunity to have that connection. So I studied these diaries. I reprinted them in my book. But because I'm a literary scholar, interested in textual analysis, I was intrigued not only by the stories being told through the diaries, but the subtext, things the writers did without even really being aware they were doing them. Part of the research then that I did was into this kind of analysis, and I will hit only a few of the highlights here. One of the things I found really interesting in their writing was the many ways that the military affected them without their recognition of it. These were people who grew up apart from the world and for the most part lived in insular Mennonite communities. When they got into military camps, they denied every aspect of military culture, refusing even to put on a uniform or to work in camps. except that their diaries leave the traces of how the military affected them. I don't know if you could read this. The first one says, cold morning, I worked on wood detail until 10 o'clock, then police. Now, that's not a language that a Mennonite farmer would probably use. That's a language of the military, and it shows up in his diary. The next one, next day, got located. My man got me before dinner. The first thing I had to do was police up the horse stable. Again, using military language that appears over and over throughout their diaries. So the culture had impacted them in some ways, even as they impacted the culture. Another interesting aspect I saw in the text was the imprint of Mennonite literature in the diaries, primarily biblical texts, plus the martyr's mirror. Evan Beck, who teaches or has taught at Goshen, outlined some of the archetypes that Mennonite authors used in their writing in an essay called The Signifying Minnow. And he talks about how Mennonite archetypes appear in all kinds of literature. And I was able to apply many of those archetypes or those themes to the diaries that I saw. For example, the theme of work and hope is prominent one in Mennonite writing, and I would say in Mennonite lives. The sense that there should be, that we are a people of doing rather than of being. I saw this often in the Mennonite diaries, the sense that they should work with the hope that something would happen for them, that their conscientious objection would have some result. So you'll find in the diaries often what is focused on is the work that the men are doing or the work that they are not allowed to do. Being idle struck Mennonites as very difficult. It was difficult for them because they were not used to being idle. Ingrained in our church is the idea that we are not to be an idle people, that we are to be a doing people. And that theme showed up again and again. This is Gustav Gadart's diary. You notice every day, hauled garbage. He lists the kind of work that he does because that was important to them. Another Mennonite theme or archetype is the martyr spirit. Obviously, we have a strong sense of martyrdom from our Anabaptist ancestors. These Mennonites grew up knowing the stories of the martyrs, and the motif is carried through all four of the diaries. I see it especially in Uriel Hostetler's, who believed himself a martyr for the CO cause. And so he'll use language like this: behold, the fields, they are ready for harvest, and the laborers are few. Fit we few, ready creatures to do thy bidding, hear, and may we be able to carry thy message of love to a few hungry souls before it is too late. Chaplain wants to make soldiers out of us. Thank God we are soldiers of the cross already and would dare to die for our cause. I see similar language like that throughout the diaries, throughout the writing of COs, even throughout Mennonite writing at the time, the sense that the conscientious objectors were martyrs and that their work or their lack of work in the camps was part of their martyrdom. Another significant Mennonite image is that of community. We are a people of community. Community is important to us and has been for a long time. And Irvin Beck sees the image or the idea, the archetype of community related to the Hutterite dovecote that appears in Martyr's Mirror 2. And I see the sense of community being really important throughout all the diaries. They talked about the Mennonite community that developed. They talk about even visiting each other, like going to each other's cabins and visiting each other, kind of Sunday afternoon visitation. The importance of the community that developed there is really powerful in all the diaries I read. So again, you get a sense here, when people had to leave the conscientious objector community, it was a really important experience, an emotional experience for the writers, and they would respond to that. Uriel Hostetler often talked about crying when people had to leave his community. Well, there's so much more I wish I could communicate with you about these diaries and these men's lives, their stories. I think it's important to recognize that because of their experiences in World War I, they went back to their home communities, Some were digested well, some were maligned. But when World War II came around, the Mennonites were much better able to speak to their objections and their reasons for pacifism that had been a problem throughout the first war, that they couldn't talk about why they were pacifists. And by World War II, they were able to make those things clear. And the government also handled CO issues differently, in part because of their experiences in the First World War. Nearly a century later, though, I sometimes think we still fail to pass on the witness clearly to the next generation, or to make that witness clear to those around us. And I believe that telling CO stories can be one way of providing that witness to show others who the people of our past have been, who had to make significant choices in their lives as they dealt with their pacifism. Especially now, when I again see the culture of patriotism questioning, patriotism is questioning those who don't support the war, when pacifists are considered to be un-American because they might support soldiers but not the cause for which they're fighting. We need to find ways to speak against the old lie that Owen and all these writers were speaking against, that is sweet to die for one's country, and that the most honorable death is one on the battlefield, because I feel that message is still pervasive. Luckily, when I was in the midst of this research, I got to go to Europe with a student group, and we walked through the battlefield from the Great War. And even at the time, I could still feel, almost a century later, the stupidity of war. The scars that are left on the land, even 100 years later, this is a battlefield. You can see the mortar holes and the trenches still, almost 100 years after the war. You can see all the rows and rows of soldiers' graves. Again, the stupidity of the war. This is a giant memorial to the people who, 90,000 names printed on this wall of people whose bodies were never found in the war, but who were killed there. And again, profoundly, I felt the stupidity of war. As I was in the throes of my research, I was reminded that the stories of the men who stood against the war, like Owen, were writing against the old lie. I think we need to continue speaking against and writing against that old lie that's still perpetuated today. Interesting, all these big memorials to the war. On the last day I was there, I was walking in a small garden in London, when I came across this memorial to conscientious objectors. So we had all these huge, in France, all these great big memorials to the war. This small one, for conscientious objectors to the war. And this is what was imprinted on that small memorial. I guess it's my hope that we find ways to memorialize these people with things like this and with their stories. So I'm done, and I think I'm supposed to take questions.
Thank you very much, Melanie. I have the mic, and I'll rove around the group here. Be good to tell us who you are and ask your question as briefly as you can.
Hi, Melanie. It's so nice to hear you talk. I'm Lois Kanagi, and I just wanted to actually tell you that before he died, I did an interview with Ori Conrad from this community, who had been a CO in World War One. That tape is in our library here. And I think I also maybe have an extra one that I could mail to you if you're interested in that. I just thought you might want to know.
I didn't do much research, actually, on COs in Oregon because I was relying so heavily on the archives in the Midwest.
Melanie, why did you choose the four that you used? I'm sure you found lots of others you could have used as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I'd be tactful. They were the best. They provided the richest material, those four. They provided the most variety of experience. Many of them were hard to read because they'd been Xeroxed or kept in archives and then crumbling. And it was really easiest to read as well, though some of them were fairly difficult to decipher. I think now in the digital age, I might have chosen differently because there's access to stuff even now that there wasn't access to 10 years ago that might have changed my research. I found pictures on the web on Google Images that, you know, 10 years ago I was trying to scan into my research. So I think with things changed, I might have chosen different diaries. But these did provide me with rich information.
J.C. Meyer was Albert Meyer's grandfather? Father. Thank you.
I'm Larry Eby. Did these men get support from the church organization or from their own congregations? Was there anything organized at that time church-wide to deal with this, either on the scale of what they should do or what they should, whether to go in or not, or how to deal with the draft in general?
Yeah, I would say that was it was problematic for the COs because they were getting mixed messages depending on the leader with whom they talked, depending on their particular brand of Mennonitism, so that the GC, H.P. Crable, the GC leader, was giving Mennonites some advice that was different than the old Mennonite advice. And if they're in the same camp and they're seen by officers as being Mennonite and being told two different things by different leaders, it becomes even more complex what they really should do. And I imagine they were getting different advice from the church leaders. They were getting certain advice from their parents. And so they're having all this advice come into them and not being able to filter what is truth, what they should really do. I think later in the war, as Mennonites began to mobilize and figure out ways to negotiate the government, they started to set up and make more systematic what they should do. But early in the war, the government didn't know what to do, the church didn't know what to do, and that created an interesting conflict.
That in one of your diaries, the fellow said he never heard one word from his pastor
right.
The whole time he was in.
I think that was probably John Neufeld, if I'm remembering. He was so far away from any Mennonite churches in New Mexico that it made it even more problematic because he had no support. People who were interred in places like Kansas, there's Mennonites all around them that could provide some support for them. And I'm not sure what it was like, probably on the West Coast, again, not heavy Mennonite population that made them feel more alienated, isolated.
Good question. Next.
Nancy Friesen. Melanie, I'm not sure if this is a fair question or not, but it's taking the history into today at college. And in the peace studies, you might have conversations sometimes with somebody who teaches with peace studies,
yeah.
Perhaps. But what, you know, how would this history translate into today without having the draft and with the ease of going into alternate service should they choose to? Do you have any
you know, I feel bad because I'm kind of out of touch with where Mennonites are at. I attend a Quaker church right now, but it's an evangelical Quaker church, so the peace witness is not even very strong there. And I feel sad about that. I feel sad about it for my kids and for the lack of education they're getting the peace witness. So I don't know what the response would be. At my college, at least early in the wars, you know, 2002, 2003, there was ardent support, patriotic support for the war. So the peace witness at George Fox hasn't been very strong, and that's where I live right now. So, sorry. I'd be interested in knowing what's happening at the Mennonite schools and how they're talking about the peace witness now.
I'm Lester Krupp. I did serve in the CPS program in World War II. Mm-hmm. I think my brothers from the Mennonite Brethren Church were not encouraged to go into CPS. They were encouraged more to go into non-combatant. Mm-hmm. And I think the other was varied across country. I wonder what it would be today if there were a tally taken of where people are, because it seems to me our Catholic brothers and sisters have almost outdone us in some areas when it comes to the peace thing.
Yes, I think you're right. It would be interesting to see, to hear what Mennonite churches are doing for their young people too, as they talk about the peace witness. I'm really interested in that. Again, I knew that I was supposed to be a pacifist. I don't know how much, if I really knew why. But I remember signing conscientious objection forms in my dad's office, even though I didn't know if I was going to go into the draft. I mean, there wasn't a draft for women. But I'm just intrigued by what the churches are doing now for their young people, too.
I want to speak to that. Merv Krupp, past youth coordinator here, anyone else want to, or Mary Chain, yes.
Well, I would just say that on the church-wide level, we do have a peace and justice department, and Susan Mark Landis is the chosen person to direct that office, and she lives day and night and dreams peace and justice, but that doesn't say what happens in the congregational life.
Yeah.
But there's an attempt at it. I think it's very difficult because there's no pressure for the young people to make decisions.
Yeah.
And I think even in, you know, more recent past, there was a lot of discussion about whether they should register or not, and that's not even an issue anymore.
Hmm.
So I think it's pretty difficult for people to even work at this. There's nothing, there are no choices that they have to make.
Dave, do you want to comment at all on the conference level?
Well, I don't know necessarily what individual congregations are doing. I'm Dave Hockman-Wirt, and he asked me because I'm moderator of Pacific Northwest Conference right now. But something that Mary Jane said made me think about how there is still a student aid fund for non-registrants that I get asked to give to every year that Susan Mark Landis sends out. So apparently there's still a minority of, or a small number of young people who go that route, and so they lose federal aid sometimes, and so this is meant to make up for loans and grants in that department. I know that like at our church, we still used Mennonite Central Committee Christian Peacemaker registration forms that might be what you're referring to, because I remember using them when I was that age too. So but I don't really have a good sense across the board.
Yeah, they have been found here at Albany Mennonite, and some of us are in the process of trying to get them used again. The next question.
I don't have a question, but I guess I could just respond to that from what I know, which isn't much. I just know it's pretty individual, it's kind of church to church, because I was a part of the youth cluster for quite a few years, working for Drift Creek, and then working with the youth here. And I remember having discussions about using the materials, but you know, it was kind of like if a person chose to do that in their church, it was there, but I guess I didn't ever really feel like that it was maybe even really pushed or explained to the level that maybe it could have been. But a few people, like Joseph Penner, some of you might know who he is from Salem Mennonite, have taken it upon themselves to really not only use it themselves, but try to get it into other people's hands. But I feel like if stuff like what happened here was more known by some of the young people, and there was a better sense of the history that they have come from, that might be seen as something that's more important. You know, so too bad there's not a few more younger faces here.
Yeah, I'll say amen to that.
Kathleen Hockman-Wirt, you started talking about the poetry, Wilfred Olson, Owen, and I just wondered, in your readings about the Mennonites, did you come across any of these Mennonite conscientious objectors who were writing to external audiences, to people outside of the Mennonite, you know, or their own faith, to encourage them to, you know, think differently about the war?
Are you asking if they wrote to Mennonite audiences or outside of Mennonites? I didn't come across much in that vein. I came across a lot of people who were writing to Mennonite audiences to describe their experiences. you know, that I think Mennonite Weekly Review still has that community news, and there were a lot of people reporting in the community news, but coming out of the camp, I don't think there was much being written beyond that. I think J.C. Meyer did some writing for external audiences, but he's the only one I can think of right now.
And he also, J.C. Meyer, I believe from your book or Jim Yonke's, really came down on Mennonite leaders for their lack of action and preparation before the draft, and then for what they were doing. And one reason he went to France is to push the idea of Christian service. He was just ahead of his time, because by World War II and CPS and what came out of that, a lot of J.C. Meyer's dreams were realized, at least partially.
Yeah.
Someone had their hand up here.
Sorry. Chris Lehman, did your research, did you look at Mennonite experience during World War I in say, Canada or European countries?
I didn't. So I guess I'm American-focused. I don't know what role Mennonites would have played in European countries, or even what, I mean, did they, yeah, I don't know.
Well,
I was focused on England and France in my historical research. Mennonite concentrations in those places weren't that big. I'm sorry I can't answer that.
I think I'm correct in saying that during World War I and World War II, most of the German Mennonite experience would have been in the military. They had lost their peace witness by then. Another comment or question?
This is Mary Jane again. There are a couple things that I would like to say for current situation is that Alan Kreider, who has just retired from the seminary in Elkhart, has put together some DVDs on peace and justice, and he was asked to do this when they were still living in England. And he did this for YWAM. Most of you know what YWAM is. He did a series of kind of a historical peace and justice orientation, and I understand they're very popular, and I understand that this is kind of a current sort of way of promoting the peace concept. And I think there's much more effort to put justice in with the peace orientation. That's the one thing. There was a second thing I was going to say, that there is a young man who was in the current military who is now employed by the Mennonite Church and is working. He dropped out of the military for his conscience, to live with his conscience. And that's very current. And I just had an email from him, and he is so excited about trying to bring about some revision or reorientation of the peace and justice that we should be very aware of and be teaching.
Does he work out of Mark Landis? Okay, great, thank you.
Was there a hand here?
I won't go into any detail, but one of the most exciting points in my school days, when I was in my school days, I was in sixth grade, and my oldest in my family was a brother who got his registration to go into CPS. And I remember then that the bus driver had stopped somewhere to get something to make the bus run better. I don't know whether it was some oil or whatever. Anyway, I just thought when I got off the bus with my sister, you know, they slammed the books on us. That didn't amount to anything, but some people have to go through. And I was just really proud of them.
I might add, Clarence Reeser, in World War I, my uncle, Dave Schrott, was drafted and went to Fort Lewis, Washington. I know that he stood up for conscientious objection, but my parents had a picture of him in uniform. So I don't know just what, but my grandfather bought a farm in Alberta, Canada, for some of the younger brothers in the family to go to avoid the draft.
Yes, and that was something that some Mennonites made that choice of going to Canada to avoid the draft. Yeah. I should say there were some Mennonites who made the choice to wear the uniform, even though they objected. And there were some Mennonites who went ahead and went and fought or did humanitarian work in France. I think the men who decided to go ahead and fight had a tough row when they came back from the war, back to their Mennonite communities. They may have been embraced by their wider communities, but they were not embraced by their Mennonite communities, and that was another rift in the Mennonite community as well.
And that happened in World War II. Aftermath also. One last question. I should add a footnote to be fair to our German Mennonite brethren. Germany does now have a draft currently. It's, I think, 9 months. And non-resistance, conscientious objection has really made a rebound there. As I understand it, about 100%, virtually all of them now are conscientious objectors. Of German Mennonite youth, yes, are. That's a good question. I don't think it's the Aussiedler, the people who came recently. I don't know. I don't remember reading about them. I'm talking about the ethnic Germans who have lived in Germany all this time, the German Mennonites there. But there's a big problem if you've been reading about the history, because these Aussiedler, the refugees, just find it very hard to fit in with the traditional German Mennonite church. So they have their own denomination.
Well, and our family is blessed by the conscientious objectors of Germany, because my brother-in-law objected or did not go into the draft in Germany and came to America and met my sister through MCC, or was it MVS? MCC, yeah.
That was Amy. I was going to have Ed and Esther stand before. I told you they were our former pastors, and if any of you would like to meet them, they're. I think you know where they are now. Okay, we'll bring this to a close. It's been so good. I just want to take the liberty, I guess, to add a couple of things here. John F. Kennedy is quoted as having said, "We will always have war until men refuse to fight." Have any of you read John Krakauer's rather recent book, Where Men Win Glory? John Krakauer is from Corvallis. He's better known for Into Thin Air and the one about heaven. I forget the title of it. He's a wonderful author. Ed? I'm sorry? Well, you read it. You did read it. Good. But he talks about Pat Tillman's experience, the NFL football player who was killed in Afghanistan. There was a big cover-up about how he was killed. And it goes so well with a lot of your points, Melanie, that you made as you started about the literary comment on war. I highly recommend Where Men Win Glory by John Krakauer. Lastly, I did find that web address for this Mennonite Historical Bulletin. It is MennoniteUSA.org/history. Okay, I think we are closing now at this time, and we want to thank Melanie again for the presentation, the research, and you can tell from the audience participation that we were all really interested in what you had to say about one of the cardinal Anabaptist tenets of faith, really. Let's stand and I'll have a closing prayer.